Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again today, we're joined by Harry Dent. Mr. Dent is the president of the H.S. Dent Foundation, whose mission is helping people understand change. He's the founder of H.S. Dent, which publishes the H.S. Dent Forecast and oversees the H.S. Dent Financial Advisors Network. He's the author of many books, some of which include The Great Boom Ahead, 1992, The Roaring 2000s, and The Great Depression Ahead that came out in 2009. Mr. Dent, we welcome you back to our show.
Yeah, nice to be back.
The title, The Great Depression, that's a gutsy title, and it came out in 2009. When did you actually finish it?
I wrote that in the first half of 2008, and it came out in, I think, November. Actually, initially came out in November 2008.
And we had some pretty radical events happen in the last 3 or 4 months of 2008.
Yeah, sure did.
And how did that, although you couldn't have much worse a title than you already had, did that somehow change? Did anything surprise you as far as the intensity level? Let's put it that way.
No, only how long this stock market rally has lasted. In the book, we could see things coming. We assumed that the economy was going to get worse as it had started to. We assumed the government was going to stimulate strongly. I mean, that's as predictable as the sun coming up tomorrow morning. And so we assumed there was going to be a bounce. We said, even in that book, the stock market's going to bounce at least to 9,800 and then maybe as high as 11,800. Well, we're right in the middle of that zone right now. And our short-term indicators suggest we're probably going to go higher another couple months. So we're probably going to get well over 11,000. So we anticipated that. But we would have thought that bounce would have started in late 2008, that we would have bottomed then instead of March 2009, and we thought it would have been over by, say, September or so of 2009. So this bounce has lasted longer, but we assumed stimulus, we assumed a bounce and a recovery, and we said from the beginning that this recovery will not last because the government's going to be fighting the largest debt deleveraging in history, the greatest credit bubble, which is a tidal wave, and all they've got is a fire hose. And they're going to be fighting the baby boomers moving from spenders to savers. So as Japan found, stimulus, 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 and the economy just keeps going down. So it didn't change that much. But all I would have changed if I'd have known what I know now is, just saying that the rally is going to last longer.
How do you define a depression?
A depression is an extended downturn where you also see a deflation in prices. In other words, the consumer price index actually goes down. And the reason it goes down is that, like in the 1930s, and it's the only time we've seen real deflation in our lifetime, and of course most of us didn't live back then, it's when the bank, when a credit bubble is deleveraging and a lot of banks are failing because a lot of loans are failing. So that destroys credit and money, and that actually, despite government stimulus, which everybody thinks, despite expecting inflation from stimulus, the deleveraging of credit actually causes deflation. So that's very different because in a depression, everything goes down, real estate, stocks, commodities. In an inflationary downturn like the 1970s, housing and real estate was up. Real estate's a leveraged hedge against inflation. It likes inflation. In fact, long-term real estate correlates with inflation more than any other factor. Emerging countries and commodities boomed in the 70s. So this is a very different environment. The only thing is that the same is that in both environments, stocks will go down. But in a depression, stocks go down even more. The failure of the banking system is the biggest shock an economy can get, and we're saying the government has not saved us from the Great Depression, that later this year and in 2011 we are going to go into a real depression. They're not going to be able to stop this.
How can people not just they're on two sides of a table that's very different, though. This is what's amazing to me. There's reputations at stake. I remember a quote that Alan Greenspan said in front of Congress, and it went vaguely something like this, that I watched my whole intellectual edifice fall apart in 2008. That to me took a lot of guts to say, but it was sort of an astonishing admission that I've studied something for 50 years and come down on the wrong side. So you've got very well-meaning, very well-studied people looking at these same charts coming to very different conclusions. And it's confusing to somebody that's not an expert, because you do want to invest appropriately, and those two investments are very different in hyperinflation and deflation.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, the problem I have with economists, they do a lot of good research, and you know, nobody's probably smarter than Alan Greenspan, but the problem I see, and this is from the beginning, I always saw it, and why I didn't take economics and why I don't listen to most economists, they've never had sex and never run a business, and they're trying to explain consumer and business behavior. What Alan Greenspan, actually, I heard him say, was he was in shock that educated, intelligent bankers shot themselves in the foot. And I'm like, anybody who's been in business and studied business cycles throughout history knows that human greed takes over every time. Anytime you have low regulation and very low interest rates and bubbles building, people go nuts. The Japanese are more conservative than we are as a culture, and they had a real estate bubble in the 80s, and everybody thought real estate would never go down, and the banks lent anybody money, any company money against real estate. That's just human nature. People think in straight lines, and if things are good long enough, everybody will buy into a bubble. And you know, so to me, it's not a matter of intelligence. It's a matter of experience and understanding human nature. And that's where economists fall short. All they look at is statistics. And again, our model says it very clearly and throughout history, no exceptions. You always go from summer to fall, from inflation to disinflation, and in the fall season is when you get bubbles. That's the only time you get bubbles. And when you get bubbles, they are going to burst. And the government's always going to say we can prevent it, but they don't. They've never been able to, because once bubbles go to extremes, they have to deflate. We don't want real estate to stay at a price where young families can't even afford a home anymore. That's ridiculous. We don't want real estate to be so expensive businesses can't afford it and compete with other, you know, businesses in other countries. So, you know, the economy has its own logic, and you need to understand that logic. And people who are in business see these booms and busts and shorter cycles. They see, you know, the greed, the complacency in their own companies, and they see it with their customers. Economists never really deal with real people, and that's why they can be this far off. They shouldn't be this far off, is what we're saying.
Okay.
Scientists don't look at the same data and disagree most of the time. Economists do all the time. That there's something wrong there.
Yeah, the methodology is definitely something's wrong. How is developing the ability to predict a boom assisted in the process of predicting a depression?
Well, again, you know, one of the laws, I mean, it's first law of physics, equal and opposite reaction. I mean, the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. I mean, the difference is we have a tool that tells you the approximate magnitude of the boom, tells you how long it's going to last approximately, and when it's going to head down. It's demographics. All we do is lag the birth index 46 years for the peak in spending, and that's a fact, not a theory. And people generally follow that. And so, you know, that indicator says we're going to boom in the 80s and 90s, and we're going to peak somewhere around 2007, 8 or so, and we're going to slow down in the early 2020s. It's very simple. People do predictable things as they age. So, you know, the boom, but booms always lead to excesses and excessive lending and excess business expansion and stuff. And even without the demographic cycle, you would have natural slowdowns out of those excesses. So booms always lead to busts.
Japan's situation turned into deflation, not depression. So do you see similarities in their situation and ours, and why is ours going to turn worse than maybe theirs than theirs did?
Yeah, there's both. The similarities is they had a housing real estate bubble very similar to ours, and excessive lending against that, and unaffordable real estate doubled and went up 2.6 times in 5 years. I think for us it was 2.2 times in 5 years. And they had their demographic boom peaked ahead of the rest of the world, because they were the only major country that didn't have a baby boom after World War II, because they lost the war and they were all depressed and lots of other logic. So that part was similar. The difference is Japan went through their downturn while the rest of the world was in the greatest boom in history. So they didn't have as deep a deflation as we're going to have. and their export industries could still be humming 120%, which they did. The second thing that was different, Japan entered that crisis being a net creditor to the world, and with almost all of their debt financed by their own citizens, not other countries. So they had a lot more leeway and capacity to stimulate and keep stimulating. The United States is entering this downturn while the whole rest of the world is going down with it, because the baby boom demographics are down around the world and in all the developed countries. And there's, you know, banking crisis and real estate bubble around the world. So we're dragging the rest of the world into this, and they would have slowed anyway. So the whole world's going down with us. And secondly, we're the biggest net debtor in the world. And our government already owes trillions of dollars to foreign governments and trade balances. And a lot of our debt, about 50% of our debt, is financed by foreign investors and stuff. And again, the whole world going down with us. So everything goes down. So we're not going to have the same leeway to stimulate and keep stimulating. We're literally predicting that in 2011, when we go in this next stage of downturn and the debt overwhelms the banking system again because mortgages just keep defaulting and foreclosing, that the deficit's going to be scary. It's going to be between $2 and $3 trillion, and I don't think the U.S. government's going to have the credibility, being so in debt, to just keep saying, okay, well, $5 trillion in stimulus didn't work the first time, so now we need 10. That's what they're going to say. That's what the Paul Krugman type economists are going to say. Oh, the only thing we did wrong is we didn't stimulate enough. We didn't borrow enough money. And any 10-year-old should be able to understand that if the nature of the crisis you're in is it's a debt bubble, a credit bubble, excess of debt, adding more debt cannot be the solution. Japan did that. Japan is going to be sorry they did that. Their debt ratio, their government debt, is 2.5 times the ratio to GDP that ours is. The only reason they're barely surviving is they're still paying interest rates on that debt less than 2%, but they're going to run out of savers in the next decade or so, and they're going to have to pay market rates like the rest of the world, 3, 4, 5%, and then Japan is going to be in a deep crisis. They never really deflated the bubble. They only did it for businesses. They didn't deflate consumer credit, and they didn't deflate the leverage and the financial institutions. And so Japan is still a country that's aging faster than ever, debt higher than ever, and no way to get out of it. They did not eliminate a lot of their debt as we did in the Great Depression. So Japan is going to pay for this down the road. But we're saying the United States is not going to have the option. You look at Europe, the same thing. Greece is, you know, in the Eastern Europe, a lot of countries are there going to start defaulting, getting in trouble. And instead of telling them to stimulate, the strong countries, France and Germany, who are going to have to pick up the tab, are saying, no, you guys got to cut your budgets and you got to raise taxes. Well, that's not stimulus. So we're saying that the stimulus is not going to be sustainable.
What's interesting about that, I mean, you're talking about sovereign default, and the reaction of the people of that country has been very negative.
Yeah.
So you get strong response. So this is not going to be an easy decade to go through.
Well, you know, this is something we wrote a report on years ago. We call it the death of pensions. This is the ultimate problem in the United States system. Healthcare and Social Security benefits are already way more than we can ever afford, and they're looking at expanding that. And companies' pensions, government pensions, state and local government, every time you look, it's pension plans that are unrealistically generous. And in booms, people just think it's going to go forever, and then you get a downturn like this. And that's what the Greeks are saying. They're saying, you can't cut our pensions. And the truth is, they're going to have to cut them. And these people, they're going to be rioting in the streets. So it's not going to be pretty.
Well, that, if you look at the, and I'm real familiar with those numbers, that has to play out here, too. It really does. Not just Social Security, Medicare, but the private pensions of...
Yeah, Medicare is 5 times the... Actually, we've got a number, 40, and this is a verifiable number from the Treasury Department, $46 trillion in unfunded Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security liabilities, things already promised to people that you can predict they're going to need in the future, and that's the present value. That's adjusting for the time value of money. It's just not total dollars. $46 trillion. That's 4 times as much as the government debt, and 80% of that $46 trillion is Medicare, Medicaid. It's health care. We can't afford the health care we have, and now they're trying to pass a bill to extend it. It's absolute idiocy.
When do you think we fess up to our baby boom generation that they're not going to be receiving the benefits in the time frame they thought?
Between 2012 and 13, when the crisis kind of hits its worst, and, right. And when there's the next election, and I frankly, you're going to get a new president because Obama, whether you like, doesn't matter whether you like him or not, he walked in at the wrong time. He walked into to a bad scene, and you know, we can project with the resetting of mortgages, which is going to continue into late 2011, and foreclosures lagging that by a year. We don't really get out of this mortgage default and housing crisis until late 2012, which means the economy is not going to really recover substantially, which means whoever's in office is going to get kicked out, whether we did the right thing or the wrong thing. So we're going to get a new president in 2013, and I think by then we will have seen probably 2 years of near $3 trillion deficits, and people are going to be a lot more sober about what we can afford or not and where we're really at. I don't want this health care bill to pass now because I don't think we're in a place where we understand where we're at. So whatever we do is going to be not sustainable.
Well, it's hard to understand something you've never read. Congress has never read it, so it's tough to understand what they've been trying to vote on. When you have deflation, that exaggerates the current debt level. So that's a scary proposition. The most thought is, okay, we inflate out of this because then we'll make the dollars we pay back cheaper. Right. But when you go the other way, every dollar you owe is exaggerated. So do we solve it by actually paying it back, or do we ask for a discount? How do we end up doing solving
well,
that?
Well, the government will probably have to scale back, you know, things like Social Security and health care, you know, age requirements and things like that. But what really happens in a depression and what happened in the 1930s, you can see in the United States, was very clear. Private debt gets scaled down very substantially. So yes, at first, when deflation sets in, you know the economy drops stronger than ever, unemployment goes up, government revenues drop, and all these debt ratios, consumer level, business level, government level, financial institutions, it gets worse because the economy and sales drop. And so you're measuring that debt versus GDP or sales or something else. It gets worse at first. And that just precipitates a crisis that forces what we call a big Chapter 11 in the economy. A lot of businesses will go under or have to merge into other businesses. A lot of banks will have to write off, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars of loans. And so that's how you get rid of the deflation actually works to restructure debt and get rid of a lot of debt rather than paying it off. Because if we had to pay it all off, and like you say, in deflated dollars, which doesn't last forever, but it would be onerous. So the economy has its own logic. It bubbles, help fuel massive innovation and new business models when new technologies like the internet are moving mainstream. But bubbles always create too much debt and too much capacity and a lot of things that don't work. And the depression, the deflation cycle, quickly weeds out that debt and those failed businesses and models, and it actually makes the system stronger. We end up with stronger companies who take over the market share from weaker companies, costs get cut, real estate goes down, a lot of debt gets eliminated, and you come out of it stronger. It's just very painful. It's the most painful season, obviously, just like in winter. Winter is more difficult than summer. Both are extreme, but winter is where the economy freezes everything and then clears the deck for spring.
I think that California real estate is feeling a little bit like the stock market at the moment because we buy and sell real estate. We buy it. We're very cautious, but the inventory is very small right now. Very little, very few properties for sale. Very easy to resell something. But I look at charts all the time, and the default rate, the people that are falling behind, has doubled in the last 12 months. The foreclosure numbers has gone in half. Banks are literally not foreclosing on people, not even starting the process, because they don't know what the heck to do with the stuff if they get it.
Exactly. We call that the ticking time bomb. And that's another thing that's different about this recovery. Yes, the economy's recovering. Yes, the stimulus is going to work at first. But despite the recovery, despite 5-6% GDP, and that's not going to last, just what you say, defaults continue to go up as if there's no economy because you keep getting foreclosures from the past, hitting the market, keeping real estate prices down. So if we get a recovery and you don't see real estate prices come back to near where they were, then the banks are going to eventually have to write off a lot of these loans, and they are going to have to foreclose. And then, like you say, we can project foreclosures continuing to hit the market well into 2012. So that's what kills this recovery. when the banks realize real estate's not coming back, I mean, we're going to see the next banking crisis all of a sudden. Just when people thought, oh, it's over and the government solved it, the last banking crisis came out of nowhere. Nobody saw it coming. It was all hidden. Well, all this stuff is hidden, too. And the banks are hoping the government stimulus works and everything goes back to normal. And they're hoping, another reason they're not foreclosing, they're hoping this thing gets better and they don't have to write off these loans and they don't have to take these hits and they don't have to sell these houses at such low prices. They're going to be wrong about that.
Well, one of the troubles of inflating an asset when it got to an unrealistic level is that it can't go back there. They've changed
exactly.
The rules.
That's right. We wouldn't want it to go back.
No.
Only the banks wanted to go back.
Right.
High real estate is bad for the economy.
Right. Plus, yeah, we really didn't qualify it for it in the first place, and now there's no way we're going to qualify for it. And the willingness is missing. One of the things we probably haven't had time to touch on is there is a psyche attached to exaggerated events. So when you have booms, you have, what is it called, animal spirit working, and people make decisions that are exaggerated, and yet they'll rationalize them. On a downside, they do exactly the same thing, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, you get it. I call it a positive feedback. On the way up, you know, okay, you know, demographics are pushing the economy forward, but hey, also real estate's going up, stocks are going up, you know, profits are going up. Everything kind of builds on everything and makes things better to the point that things get ridiculous. Stock valuations, real estate, everything. When you go down and things start to go the other way, you get a negative feedback cycle. Yeah. It's not just the economy slowing and people spending less. It's, oh, gosh, now banks are in trouble, and now you can't get loans, and real estate's falling, and, oh, my God, that was my retirement plan. Oh, stocks are falling at the same time. Baby boomers haven't had a downturn where you had a major fall in stocks and real estate at the same time until now. So now they're really feeling it. In the early 2000s, yes, stocks crashed, but real estate went straight up. So most people are about 50-50 real estate and stuff, so people didn't get hit that hard. But now baby boomers are not only aging, but they're looking at their retirement savings saying, oh, my gosh, I didn't have enough in the first place. Now I'm really in trouble, which means they're going to want to save even more.
Will they also work longer?
Yeah, well, they'll have to.
Have to.
Now, the question is, can they get a job? I mean, people can be laying off, and, you know, why not lay off the older workers? They cost you more in benefits and stuff and aren't as creative. So, yeah, they're going to realize they have to work longer. They're going to have to save more. But it's going to be harder for them to keep their jobs or to get a job if they decide to work longer. Because, you know, we're projecting 15% unemployment officially and 25% unofficially when you count all the long-term people who've given up.
Yes. That's a big number. What about, and we only have a couple minutes, Val, just a couple of topics of interest rates. Where do you see them headed?
We see, usually in a crisis like this, interest rates we see going up this year because some concerns about inflation and the recovery, but more and more default risk going up like they did in late 2008, early 2009, when the economy gets in trouble later this year. But eventually, when the bond markets see that the economy is slowing and that we're getting deflationary trends, then interest rates will go down. That's what happened in the 30s. Interest rates spiked into late 31 when the crisis was building, but then came down. You had a great bull market in bonds from 1932 to 1940 when interest rates were falling because people saw, oh, gosh, inflation's never coming back. Now, it does come back way down the line, but in the next decade, we're going to see deflation. So that's good for bonds and interest rates, but on a lag. So we're telling people, if you want to buy long-term bonds, wait later this year, early next year. And if people are looking at refinancing, you know, you may want to wait until interest rates come back down again in 2000, say 11, 12, 13.
It's amazing. I don't think I'd ever have thought I'd see interest rates where they're at. I became a real estate investor in 1981 and refinanced my house at 17.5% fixed. And now, you know, we're at sub 5, and we could see something less.
We could see, I think, 3 to 4 range on mortgages down the road.
Well, at least that would be helpful to support what price we have left.
Yeah, that's another good thing about deflation. Yeah, it does hurt in one way, but it reduces the cost of borrowing for businesses and consumers.
Yeah, and the monthly payment. The website for your company is hsdent.com. Mr. Dent, really enjoyed our discussion the last couple of half hours. I appreciate you taking the time and look forward to reading your next work.
Okay, I enjoyed it too.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.